Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. My name is Edgar Lujano, producer for Catholic Answers Live and filling in for Cy Kellett today. As promised, we have Jimmy Akin here for the second hour, author of a bunch of books, which I'm not going to name off, but yeah, a bunch of books and host of two prominent podcasts right now, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and Catholic Answers' own Jimmy Akin podcast. Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Howdy, Edgar. How you doing?
Doing great. Loving life right now, which is a good thing. But it's Friday, and we all what the world already knows. Friday means a new episode of Mysterious World. So, what's today's episode about?
Yeah, well, so this Monday we had a new episode of the Jimmy Akin podcast come out, and it was about a debater's tactic called the Gish Gallop, which is where one person, usually because they sense their own case is weak, tries to change the subject by throwing out charge after charge after charge after charge that their opponent has no time to respond to. And this is used by various debaters, among them James White. And so I had a couple of debates with James White a few months ago. He used the Gish Gallop in both of them, and I thought, well, this is an educational opportunity. Let's take some clips of him using the Gish Gallop. And so we ring a bell every time he uses a new charge that isn't one of the ones we're here to debate. And people have found it very entertaining. So that was the Jimmy Akin podcast. On Mysterious World today, we completed a three-episode cycle on Medjugorje, because the church recently ruled on Medjugorje. So I did three episodes on it. 2 weeks ago, I looked at the apparitions themselves. Last week, I looked at the recent Vatican decision about Medjugorje, which didn't address the question of is it supernatural or not, but I knew people would want an assessment of that. So in today's episode, I did a bunch of research and went through the arguments, and I offer my own assessment of whether or not it's supernatural, and so people can consider the arguments and see what they think.
Perfect. Well, and you said that was a three-part series, and the third just dropped?
Yes, third part just came out today, where we look at is it supernatural or not.
Great. Well, if you want to check that out, make sure you visit mysterious.fm. And for Jimmy Akin's podcast, what's the URL for that?
Mysterious.fm, or people can also go to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. And I have both podcasts there in video form.
Perfect. Well, there you have it. And since Thanksgiving is coming up, if you have a long drive and you haven't listened to those three parts on Medjugorje, well, there you have it. Now you have something to listen to if you have a long drive to visit family. Well, Jimmy, as per usual, lines are full. Shall we go to calls?
Yes, let's do that.
All right, let's start off with Andrew in Tennessee. He's watching us on YouTube. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hello, guys. So I'll go ahead and get to my question. Mm-hmm. So first off, I think it's absolutely heartbreaking that it's like 1,000 years after the East-West schism, and they keep, it's like both the East and West keep inventing new things to get each other over. So my question is, in John 17, when Jesus prays that they may be one, when he's speaking about the future church that will be established after his death, I can't help but wonder if the way he phrases his implies that he knew they inevitably wouldn't be one. And I'd just like you to provide some commentary on that, please.
Yeah, so when Jesus prays that that they, meaning his followers, may be one as he and the Father are one, we have to recognize what type of oneness he's talking about. Now, he and the Father are one in the sense that they share the same being. They're both divine persons, and we are not, as human beings, meant to share the same being with each other. It's not like all humans are members of the now 100 billion over the course of history, you know, a single being that has 100 million persons in it. Instead, we are distinct persons that are distinct beings as well, whereas that's different with God because humans are not like the Trinity. So what type of union is he talking about? Well, he's talking about unity in an intangible quality like love or purpose or love and purpose. And he's talking on the level of individuals here because he doesn't mention the church. And so he does want his church to be one. That's a natural outgrowth of the fact that its members are one. You know, if we're one in love and one in purpose and one in doctrine and so forth, then his church is going to be one as a result of that. So that is something that's entailed by what he says, but he is speaking in the literal sense of us as individuals. He doesn't just want his church to be one. He wants all of its individual members to be one as well. And yeah, I think it's fair to infer that he knew that that wasn't likely to be the case, because otherwise he wouldn't have bothered to pray for it. And certainly by the time the gospel was written in, I would estimate, AD 65 for the Gospel of John, there were already divisions in the church. And so I would say the evangelist knew that, and that's part of why he chose to record this statement of Jesus, to indicate it was fundamentally Jesus's will that all Christians be one, and therefore that Christ's church also be one.
How's that, Andrew?
Yeah, I suppose that makes sense.
Okay.
Thanks for answering that.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. Thank you for your call. With that, we go to Kansas City, where Tony is listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Tony, thank you so much for downloading that app. What's your question today?
Hello. First of all, Jimmy, huge fan. My question has to do with deism. I'm on a personal journey of a few years. I feel like I've been able to jump the logical gap from agnosticism to deism, but I'm having some sort of logical block going from deism to theism and then to Catholicism.
Okay.
So I'm just, I guess I'm just curious. Go ahead.
What's the nature of this block? What do you specifically feel difficulty with?
I don't know. I guess I just feel like I haven't been presented with the, I don't know if it's the right argument or what, but I'm just not convinced logically to go from deism to even theism right now.
Okay, so the difference between deism and theism, the way they're classically understood, is that deism understands the existence of a God, that there is a God, and that God created the world, but that God doesn't subsequently interact with it. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
Okay, whereas I should say theism does understand God interacting with the world after its creation. Okay, so...
I could be convinced of theism, of perhaps more kind of like a skeptical theism, but I would say I'm more of like a skeptical theist.
Okay. Well, so one point I would make, and this may not apply to you since you could describe yourself as a skeptical theist, but one of the points that I would make to an actual deist is to say, look, if God created the world, he obviously is capable of interacting with it. And so it's then a matter of his choice, unless there's some counter argument that the deist would like me to entertain. It's a matter of his choice how much or how little he interacts with it. In fact, from a classical Christian perspective, he's constantly interacting with the world because otherwise it would cease to exist. In fact, the church speaks in terms of him continuously creating the world. So, you know, if at any given moment God didn't interact with the world, it would just it would fall into oblivion. It wouldn't exist anymore. So he is interacting with the world on this view. And if someone had a problem with that, I'd want to understand, you know, why do they have a problem with that? What's the nature of the difficulty that needs to be dealt with? What I'd probably recommend, you know, since I only have just a very brief time to give you an answer on the radio today, is I'd recommend a couple of things. One of them is I did a course for the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics. I actually, two that are relevant here. One of them is Begin in Apologetics, or it's the Introduction to Apologetics course. And I offer evidence in that for why be Christian. I use a classical apologetics approach where I make a leap from the existence of God to Jesus is his son. And then I offer evidence for that being the case, especially evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. I also include a lot of stuff in that course that is on other topics and that, you know, and consequently, I don't go too deep into this subject, but I do go deep into it in another course called Evidence for Christ, where I talk about a variety of different ways in which we have evidence that Jesus is the Son of God, and it essentially involves the same leap. I start the course with assuming the existence of God, because we have a whole prior course called Evidence for God that deals with God's existence. And here I'm specifically focusing on the leap from mere belief in God to belief in Christianity in particular. One of the things I do focus on is the evidence for Christ's resurrection, which is quite robust. So I would, given just a brief radio answer, I would recommend that you get that course, and it's an online video course. Get the course, work your way through it, and see if that helps you out. Also, I'd invite you to think about specific things that you feel hold you back from adopting this. Like, you know, do you have a problem with the existence of miracles today? Why do you have a problem? If you acknowledge that God did interact with the world, at least at the beginning, and maybe to maintain it in existence, why do you feel difficulty about the idea of more particular miracles? Or do you? Or is it just you haven't been presented with evidence for the major Christian miracle, Jesus's resurrection, or things like that? And if you're able to articulate a little more fully what the specific issues are that you feel are holding you back, then I'd be more than happy for you to call back and explain them to me, and I'll do my best to help you out.
How's that, Tony?
That's great. I will definitely check those out. And thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Tony.
No problem.
Thank you for your call. Just letting you know, we do have our sale at shop.catholic.com. Everything's on sale right now from 10 to 25% off books. And I think a lot of those courses are also on sale for anybody else who wants to check those out. I think they're discounted quite a bit. So with that, we're going to go to our first break. And when we come back, we will continue on with more questions with Jimmy Akin.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Wherever you are in the world, you can access the EWTN Global Catholic Network. It's everywhere. You can get EWTN's great Catholic programming on your car radio, at home on your TV, computer, or smart speaker. With EWTN's app, you can take EWTN everywhere, on your phone or mobile device. If you want your news in print, turn to EWTN's paper of record, the National Catholic Register. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Catholic
Catholic Answers Live, Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. We do have one line open, so if you want to call, go ahead and give us a call at 888-318-7884. With that, we go to Nathan in Columbia, watching on YouTube. Nathan, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Nathan. You're on the air.
My name is Vincent. I think there was a mistake.
Vincent, okay. Apologies, Vincent. And go ahead with the question.
Okay. Not a long time ago, I asked Jimmy a question about the death penalty in the Old Testament, and he gave me a pretty good answer. Mm-hmm. But it gave me another question. I would like to know the answer. The question is, how can we reconcile the fact that God shaped the law of the Jews, with also the fact that he commanded the death penalty for people that, as you said, we're not dangerous to society, or we're not dangerous in general, because that kind of things, like the death penalty for that kind of things, we would consider that to be intrinsically evil today. So I would like to know more about how can we reconcile those aspects, like God shaping the law, but at the same time commanding those laws. I will let you know.
Okay, so I want to make sure I understand the new question. Are you asking why God has the death penalty in the law for cases where we would not regard the person as a threat to society, or is it more than that?
Yeah, like the example I gave the last time was in Leviticus, the daughter of the high priest, for example, or... where she, if she becomes, she can be put to death. So you said that the people, or the Israelites at that time, wouldn't allow the real standard of God. So he shaped the law to them. But my question is, like, how can we, like, shape the law, but at the same time God says, like, kill that person, you know? That's actually my question, because today we wouldn't do that. Like, we think that would be, I don't know how to put it, but I...
In that case, let me take a stab at it, and we'll see how well I'm able to answer it. Okay, so why would God... have death penalty prescriptions in the Jewish law for people that we would not regard as a threat to society today? Well, I think there are two prominent factors that are relevant to this. The first one is the law is shaped by what the Israelites were willing to accept at the time the law was given. And so this is over, 1,000 years before the time of Christ. And they were just at the beginning of their journey with God. You know, they were still even worshiping other gods. And so what God did was lead them into a greater appreciation of his will over the course of time. And this is something that Jesus himself alludes to. When Jesus is asked, why did Moses let us write a bill of divorcement for our wives to divorce them, if that's not God's will, like you're saying, he says, Moses wrote you this commandment because your hearts were hard. And so the Israelites would not have been prepared to just give up divorce and remarriage. And so God permitted it, even though it wasn't God's will, properly speaking. He at least wanted to regulate it and say, okay, if you're going to divorce someone, at least you got to give them a bill of divorce so they can prove they're not legally married to you anymore. But that really wasn't God's will. It was just the kind of the most the Israelites were willing to accept at that time. And the same considerations that affect that aspect of the law are going to affect other aspects of the law, including the application of the death penalty. So if the Israelites kind of basically insisted, you know, that a particular situation warranted the death penalty, God was willing to tolerate that, whether or not it was his, whether or not it was his ultimate will. The second factor that's involved is economical in nature, because to back then, most people were living hand to mouth. You know, that's I may need to explain that, since I don't know if they have that idiom in Spanish. But basically, most people were very poor. They had very few resources, and they were just barely staying alive. You know, starvation was a common thing in the ancient world. And so so there was a big limit on the resources that society had available. And consequently, it didn't make sense in any ancient society to say, oh, this person's not really a threat to society. Let's just put them in jail and keep them in jail forever, because that would mean that you've got to lock, you have to have a building to lock them up in. You have to have guards to keep them in there, and you have to support them for the rest of their life. You've got to pay for their food. Well, everybody else is struggling to get food. So why should you set someone up to be given free food for the rest of their life? That doesn't make any sense to the ancient mind. And so they would say that locking someone up was made the person a harm to society, because they're consuming resources that other people need to survive. And so even though we might think, okay, this person isn't a threat to society, they actually are if you lock them up. And so it was better and simpler and ended the threat to society if you just killed them. On the other hand, and hence the death penalty. On the other hand, if their crime was less of an order of magnitude, then you didn't have to either kill them or lock them up. You could just say, make them pay a fine, or give them a beating or something like that, and then cut them loose. So in the ancient world, there was a tendency to deal with crimes in terms of punishments that could be meted out quickly. Either you kill them, or you beat them, or you give them a fine that they can pay, or if failing that, you sell them into slavery. But they didn't have a prison system for long-term housing of prisoners, and so that's the second factor. Now, today we have a much vastly richer society than back then, so we do have prisons, and that opens up options for us in terms of how to treat prisoners that really weren't on the thought map, that really weren't part of the mental furniture that people in the ancient world had because of their resource limitations. So I would say it's a combination of two things. One, what the Israelites were willing to accept, and two, what options they had available that could be administered quickly.
Vincent?
Okay, I understand. So, for example, in the case of adultery and that kind of things, like mm-hmm. God should shape like the law according to what the Israelites were able to accept, right?
Yes, that's correct. So in the case of adultery, for example, this was viewed as a horrendously horrible crime, because if someone seduces your wife and they commit adultery, that was regarded as an extreme personal offense, even worse than it is today. And the Israelites would basically demand the death penalty for something like that.
Okay.
Okay. Vincent. I understand. Thank you. Muchas gracias.
All right.
Sure thing.
All right.
De nada.
There we go. Perfect. Well, I guess this would be a good, great time to mention Respuestas Católicas since we're speaking in Spanish now. So check out our Spanish website. If you are a Spanish speaker or have family who are Spanish speakers and you want to introduce the Catholic faith to them or have those defenses in Spanish ready, we have our website translated into Spanish, respuestascatolicas.com, or we have a YouTube channel where we also have AI translated videos and some original content too that we do in Spanish, including, I know Jimmy, you speak some words in Spanish, but we have you fully translated via AI.
Bueno.
There we go. Perfect. Well, I believe there's going to be one line open. So if you want to talk to Jimmy, you're more than welcome to give us a call at 888-318-7884. And like I mentioned earlier, and I want to bring it up again, we do have a current sale going on at shop.catholic.com where we have prices reduced down 10 to 25%. One of those books that's also available is the Big Book of Catholic Answers that was recently just published. So this is going to be 25% off if you go to check out and use the code Big Book. It's got a lot of really cool answers in here. It's a more of a reference book, but it would make a great gift for those family and friends who are involved in the apologetics world to have on their shelf. And as the years go on, we're going to do three different, there's going to be three volumes. So something to look forward to over the next couple of years to add to your collection. So we do have one line open. So if you want to give us a call and get on with Jimmy, then we will. After the break, 888-318-7884.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
What a treat. We have groovy music on a Friday. So it's always a blast. Well, I guess if Jimmy Akin is on, you got to have that groovy music. Well, I'm not going to give the phone number out because the lines are full. So from one Jimmy to another, we go to Los Angeles, where Jimmy is listening on Sirius XM satellite radio. Jimmy, you are on with Jimmy.
Hello there. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, my friend. Go right ahead.
Great. I am honored to speak to you, Jimmy. I'm a believer.
The honor's all mine. What's your question?
My question is, Thomas A. Kempis, author of The Imitation of Christ, mm-hmm. Why isn't he a saint? I've heard rumors, but I want to see what the straight story is.
Well, the straight story is because he hadn't been canonized, you know, and then we can speculate on, well, what are the reasons for that? One of the principal reasons is there hadn't been a big push to get him canonized. In terms of a rumor you may have heard that he was buried alive or something like that. And since he was buried alive, we don't really know how he died. You know, there weren't witnesses to maybe he lost the faith or maybe he didn't accept death serenely. There's a rumor that they found scratch marks on the inside of his coffin after he was buried alive, which would indicate he didn't accept death serenely. And these rumors are problematic because we don't really have evidence that's good that he was buried alive. And even if he had been buried alive, that wouldn't necessarily stop the church from canonizing him. So there's, to my mind, a big question mark over those rumors. Now, it's possible that the reason, and I'd have to investigate this to see if it's true, but it's a possibility that occurs to me that the reason that a movement for his canonization didn't develop, given that he was a very famous spiritual writer, is that people believed the rumors, and that stopped a movement for his canonization from forming. Because one of the things that you need in order to get canonized is to have some kind of a movement that is, you know, pushing for your canonization, and then a bishop authorizes an investigation, and there are resources that get invested in all this. And he just didn't have that materialized for him. And one possible reason is could be that people believed the rumors, and so one never formed.
All right, Jimmy, we're going to go ahead and leave that right there. We're moving over to Wynnewood, Oklahoma, where Cole is watching us on YouTube. Cole, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Mm-hmm. My question is kind of vague. There's a recent kind of resurgence in a fascination with pagan cultures due to the recent developments in archaeology and the discovery of these vast, you know, ancient technologies that these people use to build all this stuff. Well, there's a popular fascination with young men that I've found, and I'm kind of wondering how do I speak to them in a way to kind of draw their attention away from these kind of ritualistic pagan practices that these people might have been partaking in, and kind of if there's a biblical argument to be made for how they fit in into the timeline to argue for the validity of the Bible. And I think mainly my concern is just for the danger of kind of a new age fascination with these, you know, shamanistic practices and, you know, psychedelics kind of made popular by people like Graham Hancock and stuff like that. I know it's kind of vague, and I won't be offended if there's not an easy answer.
Well, let's see if we can make it a little less vague. So you referred to technologies used to build stuff, advanced technologies used to build stuff. And you're also alluding to things like the use of psychedelics and so forth. Those are sort of two different issues. When you refer to ancient technologies used to build stuff, what are you thinking of?
Well, say take the pyramids of Giza, for example, giant stones that there's no scientific explanation, and people point to maybe that these people had an unknown power that they might have gained through ritual practices, you know, and just an unhealthy fascination with that is kind of my concern.
Okay, so this is a version of what's known as alternative Egyptology, and the claim is that the pyramids contain, you know, rocks that are too big to have been moved, and so maybe they had some kind of anti-gravity or some kind of amazing technology that we don't have. In order to build the pyramids, and this is a common claim in alternative Egyptology. It's also false. There are aspects of the construction of the pyramids that are unclear to us, but we know how they did it in broad strokes. They apparently had levers or block and tackle that they could use. Herodotus refers to them having a machine that basically, you know, current archaeologists would say is, you know, it could have been a lever system or a block and tackle system. And one of the biggest mysteries is why is there no ramp leading up to the pyramid? Because if there had been a ramp, a big long one needed to get up to the top, we would be able to find the remains of that. And it's not practical anyway, because its volume would have had to be greater than the volume of the pyramid itself. But there are explanations to account for that. For example, there is a French archaeologist who has promoted, architect. There is a French architect who has proposed a very plausible internal ramp theory, that they basically had a ramp inside the pyramid that wound around it as it went higher and higher, and they covered up the exterior of this ramp, and they may have used the grand gallery in the pyramid as part of a lever system, a block and tackle system, to haul some of the bigger stones up there. And so what I would suggest in that regard is familiarizing yourself with some of the responses of mainstream archaeology to alternative Egyptology. I'll give you a few recommendations in that regard. One of them is a book by the Egyptologist Bob Breyer, B-R-I-E-R, called Egyptomania. And he deals with a lot of this crazy alternate Egypt stuff in it. So the book is Egyptomania by Bob Breyer. He also has a documentary on how, on the French architect's internal ramp theory, which is very good. And you can find that on YouTube. If you just type in Bob Breyer, how the pyramids were built, internal ramp, that should come up. Also, there are a couple of channels I can recommend. One of them is called Ancient Architects, and it's by a British gentleman who started out in the alternative Egyptology world, and he has old videos where he's advocating alternative ideas. But as he honestly faced the evidence, and over a period of a few years, he abandoned the alternative Egyptology ideas and realized mainstream Egyptology is right. So I would check out Ancient Architects. There's also another one called History for Granite, G-R-A-N-I-T-E, like the stone. And it also has a bunch of information about different sites in Egypt and how various monuments were built. So I would recommend Bob Breyer, especially his book, Egyptomania, and his documentary on the building of the Great Pyramid with the internal ramp theory, and the YouTube channels Ancient Architects and History for Granite.
Cool. Thank you so much for your call. Hopefully those resources will help, and give us a call when you discover some more, because that's a fun conversation to keep going down. We will go over to Colin in Newfoundland, Canada.
Oh, wait. Let me tie up one thing on Cole's question.
Okay.
So if there were technologically advanced ancient civilizations, that wouldn't be a problem. It depends on which civilization you're talking about, how it would fit into the biblical timeline. I mean, some people would say, oh, there was an advanced civilization 12,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago. Well, that would just be earlier in Genesis. On the other hand, if mainstream archaeology is right that the pyramids were built, you know, in the Old Kingdom of Egypt, well, okay, that's a little bit later in Genesis. So, you know, there are ways to reconcile proposed civilizations with the chronology of the Bible, but it's going to depend on which civilization you're talking about.
Okay. Well, there you have it, Cole. Appreciate your call. Let's go over to Colin in Newfoundland, Canada, watching on Catholic.com. Colin, go right ahead with your question.
Hi. In university, I took a seminar course with a Jewish professor, Dr. David Novak, where, along with other things, he proposed a hypothesis that Jesus' teachings can essentially be read as a sort of Pharisaic midrash. I thought this was interesting since it did allow him to read and consider Jesus in terms of his own tradition, but to what extent could a Catholic agree with that reading of Jesus, since I would suspect most Catholics would say Jesus was not himself a Pharisee, and being God, his teachings would be more than merely midrashic?
Yeah, so just for folks who aren't aware, Midrash is a Jewish interpretive technique, and I need to distinguish here what I heard you say from another position. Is your question about the teachings of Jesus themselves having a midrashic dimension, Or is the question about the stories in the Gospels being merely midrash as opposed to historical narrative? Is it the first or the second?
His hypothesis was essentially that Jesus was himself a Pharisee and that he was doing essentially like midrashic conversation with his peers.
Okay, well, Jesus isn't himself a Pharisee. He didn't identify as one, as illustrated by the fact he's frequently very critical of the Pharisees. Having said that, he is close to the Pharisees. He's certainly closer than to the Sadducees or to the Essenes. So there is some similarity, and there were commonalities in the interpretive systems that are used in the New Testament with various Jewish systems. You know, St. Paul, for example, you can see St. Paul handles various Old Testament texts in ways similar to how they would be handled by later rabbis who were an outgrowth of the Pharisees. So I wouldn't have any problem saying that, you know, Jesus used interpretive techniques of his time and his teachings have a midrashic aspect. But since he's God, everything he says is going to be right. And not everything everybody says using a midrashic technique is going to be right. So the thing about Jesus's teachings is they're guaranteed to be right, but that doesn't mean that they have no elements in common with the interpretive systems that were used in his day. It was just Jesus would have employed those systems correctly.
Colin?
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right.
Thanks for the help, Jimmy.
No problem.
Thank you, Colin. Thank you for your call. With that, we go to our final break for the hour, and when we come back, we'll go through some more calls with Jimmy Akin.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
EWTN Religious Catalog has great gift suggestions for Advent and Christmas, including personalized plaques, wall crosses, and holy water fonts. Commemorate weddings, baptisms, ordinations, special occasions, and more. To see the full selection and find more great gift ideas, visit EWTNRC.com today.
Catholic Answers Live, Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. Let's go back to the calls because there's plenty to go through and just not enough time. Tom in Columbus, Ohio, listening on St. Gabriel Radio. Tom, go right ahead with your question.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My question is, were there two different sets of humans in the beginning? One that's described in Genesis 1:27 and then one, the other man and woman described in Genesis 2:7.
Well, there have been discussions about this subject. There is a proposal, and there have actually been several over the course of time, but one proposal is that God initially created a broader human race, and then within that he created two individuals who kind of had what's called the federal headship of the race, that they were its representative members before God, and so when they fell, everybody fell. The other people then are referred to either as pre-Adamites, meaning they existed before Adam, or they're referred to as co-Adamites, meaning they were created and existed alongside Adam and Eve. There are speculation about these has not really been encouraged in Catholic circles, although there has been you know, there has been a conversation going back a couple hundred years about this. These days, the church is allowing a variety of different views in this area to be entertained, and that's one of them. However, I don't think that that, I'll just tell you my own opinion, I don't think that's the way to take these passages. We do have two creation accounts in Genesis. One focuses on the world in general, and the other focuses more particularly on Adam and Eve. And I think that they're meant to be the same. I think that we get the broader creation account in Genesis 1 and just a tiny little bit at the beginning of Genesis 2 for the seventh day. And then we back up in time and zoom in on that initial creation. So I don't think that the text is trying to teach us two creations. I think the author of Genesis understood there to be one creation of mankind, and he's describing it from two different perspectives. Now, that doesn't settle the question of, was it just two people, or could there have been a broader population with two federal heads within it, or could Adam and Eve be a symbol of the whole community? But I think the author of Genesis is envisioning a single creation of mankind, and he's just describing that single creation twice and giving us different presentations of it.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks.
No problem.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for your call. Thank you for your question. We go to Phoenix, Arizona, where Esteban is listening on Catholic.com. Esteban, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So I had to wait until Friday for this to be answered, because they said it's better if Jimmy A can answer this. So my question comes from something that happened to me. A Lyft driver was driving me to church, and they said that the church I went to supposedly is haunted by the old priest I used to serve there. And that got me thinking, why are there spirits there? Why aren't they in heaven? Like, why are they still here?
Okay. Well, first I'll tell you the historic view, and then I'll give you a bit of a modern update to that view. The historic view is when you have the apparition of a human spirit that is not an apparition of a saint and not an apparition of a damned person, then it's an apparition of someone who's in purgatory. And that has been used to explain the appearance of ghosts. You know, now it's not a saint. It's not the Virgin Mary or Saint Benedict or someone like that. But if someone who doesn't appear to be in heavenly glory shows up again, the standard view is, okay, this is someone who's still being purified on their way to heaven. And they may be working out part of their purification here on earth, so to speak. Like, you know, maybe they had duties that they didn't perform the way they should have in this environment. And so that's why they're in this environment. You know, I remember reading, I think, and I may have this wrong, but I remember reading an account some years ago about like a nun who let her mind wander too much when her community was adoring Jesus in the Eucharist. And so her purgatory involved her sitting in the chapel, adoring the Eucharist and making up for what she didn't do during life. And sometimes the other sisters in her community would see her spirit there doing that. So it was a kind of essentially unfinished business that she needed to take care of in order to be fully ready for heaven. And that's the standard understanding in these circumstances historically. So maybe this priest is still being purified and he still shows up in the church, even though he's, working out his purification on the way to heaven. On the other hand, maybe he is in heaven and God's letting him come back and help people out in the church because he was pastor of this parish and he still cares for the people in the parish. So maybe he is a saint in heaven and he's appearing here. He's not a canonized saint, but maybe he's a saint in heaven who's come back to help people out here in the church in one way or another. Or here's the more modern perspective, and I'm not saying it isn't one of the first two I named, but it could well be. But there's a third option that modern parapsychology would mention in addition to the other two that I mentioned. And that is that this isn't really an apparition. I'm assuming it's not just people's imagination. I mean, it could always be people's imagination. But if something paranormal is happening here, a third option would be this is a haunting. And a haunting is not what you'd think. Hauntings appear to be recordings, place memories, where something happened in the past and maybe it happened repeatedly and it left some kind of residue that people are still picking up on today. And that's what a haunting is in parapsychology. So this gentleman used to be the pastor. He was in this church a lot. He did a lot of things in this church. Maybe he left a kind of imprint on the church back when he was alive. And people are now picking up on that imprint, even though his spirit is nowhere near here. And the way you then tell the difference between a haunting and an apparition is hauntings are repetitive and non-interactive. You almost never can hold a conversation with a haunting. It's just like a recording that plays periodically. Whereas apparitions are interactive and purposeful, and you can have a conversation with an apparition. So if the reported appearances of this priest are repetitive and he doesn't really talk to anybody, he doesn't really interact with anybody, that would sound to me like it's a haunting. It's a recording or imprint of the priest from back when he was alive. And his spirit's not really here at all. But if he's interactive and responds in a purposeful way to the living, then, and so like you could have a conversation, for example, then it would sound like it's an apparition either of an uncanonized saint or someone who is still being purified on their way to heaven.
Esteban, thank you for your call. We're going to go ahead and leave it right there. I want to see if we can get Frank from Michigan. If you can be very quick, we can definitely get you an answer.
Hello, this is Frank.
Hey, Frank, go right ahead.
Hello. So my question is, I think I've found one or two separate articles on Catholic Answers talking about mortal sin, and one references the Code of Canon Law, saying that one should not attend Mass or receive the Eucharist in the state of mortal sin.
Ooh, one's not supposed to receive communion in a state of mortal sin, but actually you're required to go to Mass on Sundays and holy days of obligation, even if you are in a state of mortal sin.
Okay. Frank. Yeah, I was looking for some clarification.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Frank, that was...
Was Frank, was there more to your question, or was that it?
I suppose if I may follow with an addition. For someone struggling in a state of mortal sin, what sort of helps? I know, as you just said, attending Mass or perhaps sacramentals or prayer to God.
Yeah. All those things can be helpful. Now, it's going to depend on what sin it is one's trying to master. It's also going to depend on an individual. For example, one of the very common sins that people have to deal with is sexual in nature, especially when they're younger and especially if they're male. Self-stimulation can be a problem. And some people report that praying to the Virgin Mary, who's the purest of all, and asking for her intercession and protection and help me become pure, that helps them. So you could try that. You could experiment with that. If it helps you, great. Or, you could try someone else. You could say, try praying to Abraham, who, is the father of the faithful. And you can say, help me become a man who's a master of my of my impulses, like you are. You know, you walked with God, so help me achieve that too. So prayer is one option. Another option that I strongly recommend, and frequent in the sacraments you already mentioned, another option that I strongly recommend is whatever the sin is, regardless of what it is, look for your triggers and figure out what your triggers are. You know, what leads you? How does, when you get on that path that leads you down to that sin, how does that path start? And then find ways to try to avoid going down that path. Also, when you're tempted, just think about something else. Make a list of things in advance of other things you can think about, and then think about those instead, or other tasks you can perform that will get your mind off of this subject, whatever it happens to be.
Frank, thank you so much for your call. Hopefully that was helpful to you. And with that, Jimmy, the hour's over. It flew by.
It did, yeah. Nice working with you, Edgar.
Likewise, Jimmy. Well, with that, I guess we'll call it a day and a week. So thanks, Jimmy, once again.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, that'll do it for us here at Catholic Answers Live. We'll see you guys next week. And if I don't see you guys, have a happy Thanksgiving and a safe drive. God bless.